The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program. WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
Good afternoon. I am Vina Jones Cox, and this is Real Life Real Estate Investing, where this week, like every week, we bring you the information and inspiration you need to start or grow your own real estate investing business. It's the second Wednesday of the month, which makes it question and answer week, which means normally I would have absolutely no show without you guys giving us a call at 877-772-9658. Again, 877-772-9658, or asking your questions via email at vinaradio@gmail.com. I say most weeks I wouldn't have a show without you, but this week we actually have a guest here for the first couple of minutes of question and answer week just to update us on some important stuff that is going on in Ohio in the real estate investing world. Joining us by phone is Maurice Thompson, who is an attorney and the executive director of the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law, who's working on not one but two separate court cases right now that, depending on the outcome, they could have very big impacts on those of us who own or want to own real estate here in the state of Ohio. Maurice, welcome to Real Life Real Estate.
Vina, good to be back with you.
Good to have you here, Maurice. Tell us what y'all have been doing since last time we talked.
Hey, it's been a little while. First of all, as the year comes to a close, we want to thank any of your listeners who have been donors to 1851 Center. We're a nonprofit, and we don't charge our clients anything because of that generosity. So I know a lot of those people fall in that category, and I want to say thank you very much. On to the cases that I think will set the table for property rights, yours and mine and everybody else's, for the next several decades in Ohio. And our oral arguments are at the Ohio Supreme Court, January 8th, and again, February 10th. The first case, all about home inspections. The routine case that we've won many times is imposing a warrant requirement on cities trying to enter your house for a point of sale, rental inspection, any other kind of code enforcement type inspection. And we've been successful there, but the cities have responded to our victories by trying to hollow out that warrant requirement and say, hey, the only probable cause we need to get in is maybe you declined and that's suspicious, or
you wouldn't let us in.
A law saying, yeah, you know, your house looks old, so we need to get in. And our response is, listen, the requirement of probable cause in the Ohio Constitution means that you actually have to show an individual threat from that property to justify getting in, and then there has to be a nexus between that and the area you want to search. So if there's a broken window in somebody's unattached garage, maybe that's probable cause to get into the garage to see if there are bats or birds flying around in there, but that doesn't get you into the house. Very important principle, and again, it's all about bottling up these over-the-top, out-of-control home inspections, which are a major hindrance to affordability, because as soon as the blue-haired barista, who is now a code enforcement inspector, gets into your property, they want to write you thousands of dollars in mandates to fix up to try to make your house perfect in their eyes, which also can make it unaffordable in the eyes of potential purchasers or tenants. So that's the first case. And the second case is about occupancy limits. We have a client out of the city of Kent. This is the February 10th argument. As a six-bedroom home, the problem is the city says you can't have more than two unrelated people living together in your home, no matter how big, you're, again, affordability and governments trying to make things perfect in their own eyes, irrespective of whether your exercise of your property rights inflicts harm on the rights of other people. And, of course, the downside is that makes it more expensive for the tenants because they can split rent less ways and the house less valuable for the owner. And lower value there makes your neighbor's houses less valuable, too, generally speaking. So if there's problems, you can deal with those directly, not through the inspections or these prophylactic regulations. We've won variations of each of these cases before, but never at the Ohio Supreme Court. And we're hoping to set some precedents that sort of set the table for property rights for a long time to come.
I'm hoping so, too. So case number one, it's going to impact every single one of us if we own rental properties, because most of us, if we live in any sort of incorporated area, are subject to some sort of a warrantless search, which they call something different. They call it our right to inspect your house because we're the city and you're not, and it's a rental property and we have to, it's for the children. The second one is going to particularly impact people who have student housing, who want to do shared housing, co-living, pad splits, all those things that are actually solutions to the affordable housing problem. Letting multiple people live in the same place and split rent. So we're going to keeping a close eye on both of these. Maurice, your website is for folks to see what's going on with that and get your updates is ohioconstitution.org.
That's it.
OhioConstitution.org. Now, Maurice, I am not kidding you. When I came in and sat down, it's Q&A day. I came in here, I sat down, and there was a question in my inbox that I think you can give some advice on. Okay? It says, hi,
we'll
Vina. Jeff W. here. I own properties in Hamilton, Ohio. So not Hamilton County, the city of Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
This city is
Butler County.
Yes. This city has placed special assessment costs on my tax bill for various reasons. Some tenants had messy grounds, appliances, or other refuse on the property, vehicles, trash bags in the wrong place, etc. I have also been taxed for sidewalk repair and now to cut hazardous trees between the sidewalk and curb. Hamilton says they own the trees, but they are requiring me to pull permits of $130 to cut them, and then I have to pay for the removal. They have taxed me for each of these issues, giving me no acceptable recourse. That the houses are in an LLC, so I'd have to hire an attorney, which would cost me more than the special
yep.
assessment on my tax bill. What do you recommend?
Wow. Well, I'm going to try to make this useful to all of your listeners. Just recall, there are a finite number of ways that government can reach into your pocket and take your money. And in most states, and including in Ohio, that is, they can tax you through the front door. They can tax you through the back door through a fee or a special assessment. Special assessment, they have to show that the value they're giving you in exchange for that assessment is equivalent to the amount of the assessment. So there's always going to be an issue there. Sidewalks in particular, he mentioned, interesting, I think it was a he. If the government owns the sidewalk, that's the government's problem. You don't have to fix up the government sidewalks just because they abut your home any more than you have to go paint the courthouse down the road because it's government property, it's not your property, and you are not their slave. And then finally, the tree lawn, the space between a sidewalk and the road, there again, is it government property? Is it your property? How can they fine you or anything along those lines or assess you if when you look at your deed, you don't own that as part of your property? And of course, some cities, this will be a little bit different, but the cities where we're litigating those issues are cities where the government basically admits it owns the property, but it's trying to force you into servitude on their behalf just because you own an adjacent or nearby home. And, of course, that's ridiculous and that's unconstitutional. Now, if there's some sort of an easement where you do own the property and the government has an easement and there's some conditions there, whether in your deed or in a longstanding zoning code, that is a harder case. So we need to know a few more facts, but based on what we have there, it's something we could do a whole show on. But it's enough for me to be interested.
Okay. I will forward Jeff's email to you, Maurice, and because he specifically asked about is there any kind of class action that we could do against the city of Hamilton because this is insane. So
we are doing one now in the city of Painesville, up east of Cleveland, on sidewalks.
Okay, perfect. I will forward this to you, and drive home safe. We're hearing here that there's like sleet coming, and I know you've got country roads to get through before you get home. So
this is Ohio. We love driving in sleet.
Yeah. We need you. Don't die. Thank you, Maurice. Appreciate you being on this evening.
Have a great show.
You too. Yeah, you're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing. That was Maurice Thompson from 1851 Center for Constitutional Law. He's actually working on a number of cases throughout the state of Ohio that could end up having impacts on other places as well. So if you want to keep up on what he's doing, what's happening with the various cases, it's ohioconstitution.org. It's question and answer week here on Real Life Real Estate Investing. So let's get those questions coming in. You can call at 877-772-9658 or send an email to vinaradio@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox, trying to calm down after getting all wound up talking to Maurice Thompson. That happens every time I talk to him because he's always working on something that is something about the government overstepping their bounds. Okay, this is interesting. I'm getting a call on my cell phone from somebody saying they are calling for the radio show. See, this is not, I don't know how you did this. That's not the phone number. The phone number is 877-772-9658. 877-772-9658. Or you can send an email to vinaradio@gmail.com. One of the things that would be great if you would call or send an email about is what do you need to know that you do not know that would make you able to kind of kill it in real estate in 2026. I know the market is different than a lot of you are used to. There are skills that you did not have to have over the course of the last 10 years that you now need to have if you expect to make any money. But the bright side of that is that your competitors don't have them either. this market is really rewarding people who are willing to stretch and grow and learn, and or the people who already know that stuff because they've been through this kind of market before. What would you need to know or be able to do that you don't know or are not able to do right now to make 2026 not something you're just trying to survive, but like the best year you've ever had? And the reason I'm asking that question is because this is the time of year when I am doing a lot of planning. I'm doing an enormous amount of, scheduling stuff for RIA Group, scheduling stuff for the radio show, scheduling stuff for the Summit Help Night. And if you can tell me what those things are, I might be able to get them for you. That was a question that I actually asked when I sent out my e-letter yesterday. Every week before the show, I send out an e-letter and tell you what's going on the show, give you a link, give you a chance to ask questions, and also there's usually some other stuff that I might ask for help on like this. And Tanya replied and said, I need to know how to organize documents in my computer files. Every property has a different set of necessary documents. Plus, I have a mishmash of documents in various stages, different versions. Some are executed, some are amended. I don't have a methodology for dating or naming, so invariably I have to open several documents until I try to find the ones I want. Adding layers of trusts, LLCs, bank accounts, and custodians exacerbates this. Do you use a template? For example, having a system would minimize the chances that a recorded deed is not sent back to me and I forget to make sure I have it. A checklist and system would be greatly helpful to me and I bet to many others. See, you know, that's the kind of awesome question that no one's ever going to think to answer that question if you don't ask it. I get it, man. Paperwork, and it's not even paper anymore. As you say, it's computer files, is a freaking challenge. It's a challenge. And I know what you mean about there was the original version that I wrote up, and then I sent it to George, and then George wanted some changes made, so he sent me back a version, which I saved so that I could look at the changes later. And then when I got through with the changes, I sent him back another version, and none of these were the version we ended up with at the end. And so my little file is just full of things that say purchase agreement on 123 Easy Street. So I don't have a magic answer for you there, Tanya. I can tell you that part of the way that I handle it is I have, once a deal gets to the point where like it's going to happen, or we think it's going to happen, it gets its own folder in my OneDrive. So it might, 123 Easy Street would be its own folder. And I try to then save any attachments I get, save anything that I've made up, just in that folder, and then delete the version that's no longer the active version. I said I try to, I wish I was organized enough to do that all the time. But when I go back later, I'm looking for the files and I realize I've opened up five files that never happened, then I delete them. I know Matt has a naming convention that he would probably have to come in here and explain what it is, but I don't know if he's going to do that. And that's a separate thing, by the way, than the other thing you're talking about, which is a checklist. And yes, there does need to be like a closing checklist, that goes all the way through and past closing, because yes, you're absolutely right. We have found situations where we got to the closing, assumed everything had gone where it needed to go with the title company, and then looked up 6 months later and realized that we never got the deed back, or if we're the lender, we never got the mortgage and note, the recorded mortgage never came back. And then we're busy trying to track that down. And sometimes the title company still has it in the file. And sometimes they say, oh no, we sent it to the county and it didn't, I guess they never recorded it. And here we are with no proof that we've got a mortgage in this house. So yeah, checklist is a separate thing. Hi, hon. Do you have any advice for, I don't know if you were listening in the other room, but Tanya has a question about dealing with documents in various stages with different versions that were executed and or amended, and wants to know if there's some sort of methodology for dating and naming the files so that she doesn't have 100 different files to click through before she finds the one she's looking for.
Well, I agree that this is a challenging problem. I agree that there is no perfect solution to it. And I further agree that there's a lot of organization that is required to do real estate investment, particularly more complex or creative deals, and that you have to have somebody on your team who has a mentality of intention, that level of attention to detail, in order to help you with this if that is not you.
I have the feeling that it is her, because she's asking the question. It never occurred to me to ask the question, and she's asking the question.
Well, she's
asking
a good question.
So I think she's the person. She just isn't quite sure how to make this work.
I would emphasize, I don't think there's any perfect convention for this, but I prefer longer file names to include more information, including the name of the parties that are involved in the deal, at least the last name or the company name, the thing that is you are going to most remember. Because remember, what's important is that when you query this in the future is that you can distinguish it from other documents. The name of the type of document. So if it's a deed, say it's a deed in the file name, if you're going to search by that and can distinguish it from other types of documents. And I prefer to put at least an abbreviated version of who are the parties to that document, if it was signed or needed to be, and whether it has been executed or completed. I wouldn't mark a document as being such until it was, and it was agreed as the final version.
So it might, a name of a file, if George was selling me his house on Easy Street, it might be, the file name might be Jones Cox Zahn Easy Street Deed Completed, or Jones Cox Zahn Easy Street Deed Draft, or Jones Cox Zahn Easy Street Deed Recorded.
Quite possibly. And in your case, because you deal with so many assets and so many properties, sometimes on the same street, I would very likely include at least a street name, a number to distinguish it from others.
Okay. So hopefully that was helpful, Tanya. Maybe if other folks have a way that they do it, we can hear from them as well at vinoradio@gmail.com. Her second question was, I need a system to so that my heirs know what the heck I have. And Tanya, that is a way bigger question than an hour-long radio show that's halfway over. We've actually done entire Saturday meetings about this because part of it is obviously, you know, just having your wills and your trusts and your all that stuff lined up. The other part is having two things. Number one, a spreadsheet that you keep up to date every month that has maybe different tabs on it, like it might have a properties tab and a mortgages tab and an options tab, and it depends on what kind of you know, assets you have. And within those, it would have property address and then all the information, like who do you owe money to? Is there a first mortgage? Is there a second mortgage? Approximately how much is it? When is it paid? What is the interest rate? How is it sent? All of that sort of stuff for each asset. And then secondarily, you need a Dear Honey letter that says, Dear Honey, if I pass away, here's the name of our attorney. Here's the property manager you should hire to manage our properties. Here's the insurance guy's name and address. Here's the life insurance. Here's the name and number of the guy who does our furnace. Because a lot of us are in relationships where our heirs are vaguely aware that there are some properties somewhere. You know, wouldn't know what an option was even if they ran across it. So, like, you have to give them instructions about if you find any options in the file, those will need to be exercised by the date of the option. If you don't wish to exercise them, send them to Vina Jones Cox and she will exercise them. Right? You've got to have stuff pretty well outlined for civilian heirs and whatnot. So we may do another class on that this year. Tanya, it feels like it's been a couple of years since we did it. So just stay tuned for that and we'll see if we can put it together. Okay, it's a question and answer week here on Real Life Real Estate Investing. If you have questions or you have ideas about like bigger classes that should be taught this year, things that you need to get better at, to skills you need to build so that you can have a really good 2026, send it to vinaradio@gmail.com. That's V like in Victor, E-N-A, radio@gmail.com. Or, hey, call it in, 1-877-772-9658. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox, and it is question and answer week here on Real Life Real Estate, which means now that Maurice is not on the air anymore, you got to ask questions or we're just going to sit here in complete silence. So let's show the listening audience what it's like. That's awful, isn't it? Isn't that awful? Aren't you like, oh my God, let me try to turn the radio up. You got to ask questions. 877-772-9658. Or vinoradio@gmail.com. A question here from Jane. Jane with a Y. Hello, Vina. I have a Roth IRA, but not a lot of money in it. I'm wondering about this, and no one I found so far can answer it. Can a Roth IRA borrow money and then buy investment property? If you can shed some light on this, that would be great. And then she also asks whether I can recommend an IRA custodian. And so let's talk about public radio. So a lot of people, because they listen to the show on Spotify later, think that it's a podcast and thinks that, you know, I can like, we can just all advertise anything we want. Nope, this is public radio, you know, like public television, like non-commercial. So one of the things we do not do is we don't make specific recommendations about things like who is the best X, Y, or Z. I will say, Jane, about that, that, you know, most IRA custodians are going to have kind of the same set of rules, challenges, benefits, etc. A lot of people end up choosing based on, there are two big things I've heard. One is a lot of people seem to like to have an IRA custodian that's near them. That's never been important to me. I've never walked into my IRA custodian's office and said, hey, can we talk? But I know some people get, there's people who get some comfort from that. So you might want to see if there is a local custodian. The other big decision-making thing is the way the different custodians charge for their services becomes important to some people. There was a custodian that I used to use that, and I didn't stop because they like, because I didn't like them. I stopped because they don't exist anymore. They had like a three different ways that you could pay for your account services. You could either pay based on how much money you had in the account, or you could pay based on the number of transactions that were, that you were doing every year, or there was some third way. You should find out what the fees are, and you might find that there's some that are just like way more affordable for your little IRA that you have right now. Like somebody's a company with a flat fee and it's, you know, $1,000 a year or something. If all you have is $1,000, that's not going to work for you for more than a year. So, yeah. So the question, can the Roth IRA borrow money then buy investment property? Yes. And so generally that's not the way it's done. Generally the Roth IRA borrows money in order to buy investment property. It's not like I go get a loan and now I've got $100,000 in my IRA and so now the IRA buys a property. That's not usually the way it works. Usually the way it works is I identify somebody who will loan my IRA money to buy a property, and then I go find the property I want, and then the IRA gets that loan, which is secured by the property. If you borrow money ahead of time, like, what is it secured by other than your promise that you won't take it out and spend it? The thing is, the reason you haven't heard a lot about that, about the Roth IRA borrowing money, is because when an IRA borrows money in order to make an investment, the IRA becomes a taxpayer. There is a taxes on unrelated finance. Everybody calls it UBIT, unrelated business income tax, but it's really a finance tax, and it's got a different, it's UFIT, I think. The tax that an IRA pays for having borrowed money is 40%. It's a 40% tax. So it's like way bigger than what your personal income tax probably is. But there are some things that offset that. Number one, it only pays tax on the portion of the income that is attributable to the money that you borrowed. So let's do some easy, not even math, because there's no way I do math on the radio. We don't do math on the radio. It does not work to do math on the radio. So let's just do, you bought a $100,000 house and your IRA put $50,000 down and you borrowed the other $50,000. So half of the house is financed, right? And every month that house makes $1,000 in rent. Like that's what it clears, is $1,000 in rent. half of that $1,000, $500, is subject to this 40% tax. The other half is not, because the other half, your IRA, actually made the investment. You did not borrow the money to buy the other half of the house. The second thing is, because it becomes a taxpayer, it also gets to take all the deductions the taxpayers get to take. So if your rent is $1,000, you get to deduct from that the taxes, the insurance, the maintenance, the all the expenses, the interest on that loan that you took out, all the things that you would get to deduct if you were just a person owning a house. And then it's the remaining money, it's the net money that gets part of it paid taxes on and part of it not paid taxes on. It is very often the case that, depending on what you're buying and how much money you're borrowing and so on, that by the time you get to take all the deductions, and also there's like $1,000 a year, just like you just don't have to pay taxes on the first $1,000 every year, that the taxes are really minimal. But if you have a teeny tiny IRA and you're going to have to borrow a whole lot of money to buy a property, you might find that the taxes on that end up being pretty high. So how do people with small IRAs get into real estate? It happens all the time. Actually, my very first real estate investment was, I made it in an IRA that had $500 in it. And no, I did not buy a house for $500. So how do people do this? Well, they partner with other people's IRAs so that between the two, they have all the cash they need. Or they might do something like this. Maybe you want your IRA to have a property that you have identified, but you don't want to go borrow money and... Did I say, by the way, that when people loan money to your IRA, it's at a way higher interest rate than what you can get as an individual, because the only thing that serves as security for the loan is the property. You cannot personally sign to guarantee the loan. So there's companies that will do loans to IRAs, but it's like usually about 50%, like 50% loan to value and like 10, 11% interest. And you can also get owner financing. You could also like buy a property subject to in your IRA, but let's avoid all that. Let's just avoid the taxes. You go find a property that you would like your IRA to own. You call me up and you say, Vina, I happen to know that you have $100,000 that you need to spend on a house because you're doing a 1031 exchange. And I have this property that can be bought for $100,000. And what I would like to do is I would like to have you buy it, but then I would like my IRA to become your tenant. I would like to lease that property from you with an option to buy it later on. And I might say, well, that sounds pretty good. Like, I got an automatic tenant. I don't have to worry about managing the property. I got an investment for this money I need to spend. That sounds pretty good. Let's do that, Jane. And I'll give you an option to buy it in the future as well. And if I don't say yes, somebody will. If you ask enough times and you're offering a good enough deal to the other person, somebody's going to say yes to that. So you might be saying, well, how is that different? If I have to make you a payment every month, how is that different than me borrowing money with my IRA borrowing money? And the answer is, you're not borrowing money, you're leasing a property. So there's all sorts of ways to do this thing without even worrying about that 40% tax. I would say, you know, obviously go get some more IRA education. There's people out there who teach this stuff and who will keep you from doing things that'll get your whole IRA blown up. You don't want to do that. And just go look for some deals and go find some financial friends who will help you do them. So thank you for your question, Jane. Appreciate that a lot. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing. We're down to about the last, well, by the time we come back from this break, we'll be down to the last 10 minutes of the show. So if you have any questions, give us a call, 877-772-9658 or vinaradio@gmail.com. Welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Vina Jones Cox. It's question and answer week, and luckily there's been a little mini flood of questions into the inbox at vinaradio@gmail.com. So, yeah, if you got one, you can go ahead and send it in if you like. If I don't get to it this week, I can get to it during our next Q&A week. I'm curious, you guys, is what do you need to know to succeed in real estate in 2026 too difficult a question? And I'm not being snarky. I know it sounds like I am, but I always sound like I'm being snarky. I have like resting snark voice. I say that because I have asked this question probably half a dozen times in different forums over the last week or two, and I'm not really getting any answers that are not very specific, you know, or not like I specifically need this loan or this house in this market or something like that. Am I asking the question wrong? Do y'all understand what I'm trying to do here? I'm trying to put together an educational program that is going to work for people in 2026. Oh, and I get a lot of answers from really advanced investors that are they're what I'm looking for. You know, they're like, oh, how to contact motivated sellers or how to run the numbers better or something like that. But I know the people. And I know that they don't actually need to know that. What they're saying is, I think other people need to know this. Well, I want to know what you think you need to know. So question from SK. I have a co-living possibility in a city about 90 minutes from me, interested in master leasing it or ? For co-living. Looking for suggestions on how to finance / partner. I have the house. It needs about $70,000 in rehab before any co-living changes versus single family home. Well, SK, very first thing I would do is I would put together some really realistic numbers about what this would look like in a co-living situation. In other words, how many people can we house? What would be the monthly rent for each one of them? What are the utilities, taxes, insurance, all of those sort of things. Really realistic numbers, not like, oh, pie in the sky. I think we could get $6,000 per bedroom. Like really realistic numbers. And then what money do we need to get it there and how long would it be? Because, I mean, if you got $70,000 in rehab, it's not like if I dropped a check, airdropped a check to you right now, that doesn't mean it would be ready to co-live for a while because it's winter where you live and where I live, but where you live, there's also probably 10 feet of snow on the ground already. And so the rehab is going to take a minute and then getting it up and running. And I don't know if any permits are required where you are for co-living licenses, anything like that. And I would put that all together and I would say to myself, what do I need here? Do I need somebody to buy the house for me? Do I need somebody to help me with the co-living situation? Do I need somebody to make a loan or a loan in second position? Because I can get a loan in first position, but I can't get a loan in second position for that $70,000 other than from a private lender. And what do I need to offer to make that attractive to somebody? And is that, if I offer that, is it going to work with the numbers that I just put together? That's how whenever I'm looking at an investment, I'm like, hey, I'm going to come up about, I don't know, all the money short of being able to do this thing that I want to do. The first thing I do is I get out a spreadsheet and I start running numbers and saying, what's the best case scenario, worst case scenario, most probable scenario? I do all my research. I start looking at, and sometimes I get to the end and I'm like, the best I could offer somebody to put this money in is like 5%, and that's not attractive for the risk. So I need to rethink. But I need to pay less. I need to pay less for the property if I can only offer somebody this little bit of money. Then I probably need to rethink doing the deal. So question from Robert in Nashville, who I thought he was being snarky. And then I realize, which is common with Robert, that's why we get along so well. Then I realized the thing that he was hinting at me about. He says, do you have any tax tips for the end of the year? And I was like, what? Why would I have tax tips for the end of the year? Do I sound like Scott Ellsworth? I don't think so. And I had that thought and then I went, oh, I forgot to say Scott Ellsworth is doing a class this Saturday. It is free for RIA members. It's free for people who belong to Cincinnati RIA and about 12 other groups throughout the country. So you should sign up for that because it's all tax tips. It's, you know, it's like it's for newer investors, but he is going to get into some of the more, I don't want to call it out there stuff. He's going to get a little bit into 1031 exchanges and componentized depreciation and all that sort of stuff. And it is the best price of all for the end of the year, free. You should check your group's website, see if they're offering it. If not, you can go to CincinnatiRIA.com. It will cost you money if you're not a member. As a matter of fact, it just makes more sense to join for a month for $30 than it does to pay $47 or $97 to take that class.
Would that then be scot-free?
Scot-free. Yeah. I'm going to tell him you said that because he will actually find that really funny. So thank you for your hint, Robert. It's it took me a minute, but I finally understood what it was you were getting at there. Let's see if there's a question I can answer in like 1 minute, because I've got several questions here. How do I navigate my lack of confidence when I hear so much doom and gloom about the market? Days on the market are too long. Stuff isn't selling. I'm scared to lose money by buying too high. How do I manage my own brain and hesitancy? And the answer is get around people who are not scared and hesitant and ask them questions and see what they're doing and get jealous. Get jealous of the money they're making. Sit there and think, I'm smarter than half these people. Why are they able to do this and I'm not doing it? And also, this is a little bit premature because it's not up on the website yet, but our very first Saturday session in August is called the 2026 Real Estate Investor Thrival Guide. And a big chunk of it is about how do I know that my numbers are right so that I can make the offer I need to make and make it comfortably, even though it's way less than the seller is asking for, and deal with all these emotions that I have because I'm reading the newspaper too much and not talking to other real estate investors enough. So we'll let you know about that when it is available. That's the end of our question and answer week. Thanks to all the folks who asked all these great questions. We'll be back next week with more information to put you on the path to financial independence through real estate investing. Until then, happy investing.